took a few steps and groped blindly about again. I strode forward until I was standing dead center in the rear seating area of the bookstore. Mac's fireplace should have been to my right. The Chesterfield behind me. There was nothing. I got a sudden chill. Nothing wasn't quite the right word. The bookstore was gone, but a thick, gluey residue lingered, as if something cataclysmic had transpired here, leaving a miasma of emotional, temporal, or spatial distortion in its place. Perhaps all three. "This is bullshit," I growled. I'd had it. Enough was enough. Chester's nightclub at 939 Revimal Street had gone dark 2 years, 1 month, 4 days, and 17 hours ago. Not that I was keeping track or anything. The Fay-run club Illyrium on Renault Avenue had taken its place. The nine were gone, and the last I'd heard, Christian was somewhere in Scotland, holed up in an ancient crumbling castle, shades of Unseelie King, anyone? With powerful wards placed at a 75-mile perimeter around him to keep everyone out. Or him in. No one seemed sure. Now someone, or something, had taken my bookstore. The universe continued erasing the best parts of my life. Squaring my shoulders, I stalked to the empty lot where the garage should have been and studied the concrete, looking for wards, spells, any hint of illusion or glamour. Nothing. Both buildings were simply gone. As was my promise. I knew nothing about what was going on with Mac, and had no way of contacting her. Had she established control over the Fay Court? Taken them away and tidied up after herself? The bookstore was a site of immense power that she and Barons would never leave lying around for someone else to exploit or claim. Feeling oddly lost without my Mecca. Dublin just wasn't Dublin without BB&B. I spun away and was nearly back to the street when I felt a rumble beneath my feet. Paused and cocked my head, listening intently. There it was again. Faintly. So faintly, I'd almost missed it, even with my superb hearing. The baying of an animal. A wounded animal from the sound of it. Badly wounded. Not a wolf. Something... Fay? Terrible sound. Pain. So much pain.
I'll never let you be lost again.
Out of the blue, Riordan's voice exploded in my head, deep and faintly mocking. I had no idea how that memory escaped incarceration from the high-security ward of my disciplined brain. All my that-man memories were under strict house arrest, locked down tight. I didn't think about Riordan anymore. There'd been a time the sheer number of superheroes in Dublin had annoyed me. Now I was a wolf without a pack. There'd been a time everyone had wanted me to open up, let them in. I'd complied. A word I can barely think inside my head, even when it's the right thing to do, without hackles sprouting like poison ivy all over my body. And what did they do? Left. I was feeling as volatile as my Hellcat, but the bookstore's disappearance was the last straw. It began to rain, further dampening my mood. Rain is just what Ireland does. You'd think I'd be used to it. I hold a deep personal grudge against rain. It makes my hair go curly and wild, completely undermining the cool, composed look I like to project to the world. Breathing deep, I kicked up into the slipstream where I could avoid the raindrops. Unless animals began attacking Dublin, whatever was baying wasn't my problem. It sounded like it was dying anyway. And if such an attack did come, I knew one very hungry Hellcat that would relish the job. I turned my focus back to what I excelled at. The hunt. Dublin, or Dublin, the Black Pool, with its many colourful inhabitants, was my city now, more so than it had ever been, given every bloody damned one of my fellow warriors had bloody well decamped. I would protect it. I lost my prey at the mirror, or rather, I let them go, unwilling to leap blindly into a silver with an unknown destination. I'd been closing in fast when the three men ducked into the entrance of an abandoned, crumbling brewery on the north bank of the River Liffey. I'd shadowed them through the gloomy industrial interior and was about to ease up into the slipstream to nab them when they abruptly vanished into a wall. I approached with caution. When the song of making was sung, repairing the fabric of our world, I'd thought reality would return to a semblance of normal. The Fey-induced changes to our planet would reverse. The Light Court would retreat to their own realm, despite the lack of a wall between our worlds, and society would resume its usual bleating, morally ambiguous course. In retrospect, I don't know why I thought any of those things. Perhaps I just wanted a happy ending. None of it happened. Post-song reality was one in which the rules only became clear by interacting with them, often with unpleasant consequences. Children were being born with unusual gifts, although I'd call some of them curses. Objects didn't always function quite like one had every rational reason to expect. Doors didn't consistently go where you thought they would, and mirrors were the most unreliable of all, even human ones. Magic burned in the planet, more potent than ever, as if the ancient melody had penetrated deep into the earth, crooning in dangerously random fashion, "Awaken." Everything had gotten more juice. Even us she-seers. The many new elements of unpredictability had changed my behavior. I traveled in the slipstream only for short distances now, under calculated circumstances. There was too much I needed to see, less I could take for granted, and I absorbed few details moving in a higher dimension. I skirted a large vat to get a closer look at the silver. Embedded in stained and crumbling brick, a narrow black opening rippled in the wall, 3 inches from the floor, stretching all the way up to the decaying rafters. Something about the slender, dark aperture made my blood run a little colder. A gust of stifling air belched from the shivering surface, reeking of wood smoke, and I cocked my head, sniffing. Old copper? Perhaps blood? Distantly, I heard a rhythmic chant, thousands of voices, perhaps tens of thousands, repeating something over and over in a nearly hypnotic cadence. It wasn't English. I didn't recognize the language. I eased warily closer, kicking through several inches of litter and broken bottles, sending a small horde of roaches skittering into shadowy corners of the room. All mirrors debut on my dangerous list. Few of them work their way off it. I wasn't even willing to put one in my bathroom until it underwent rigorous testing. A person with normal hearing would have heard nothing coming from the dark glass. But I'm not normal. I catch the gentle whoosh of air displacement as people move. If I lay my ear to the earth, I hear countless insects wriggling and tunneling in the top layer of soil. I still couldn't decipher the words, but the indistinct chant was now threaded by thin, distant, blood-curdling screams. I narrowed my eyes, focusing my she-seer gifts on the inky darkness, as if I might penetrate the veil. Still, I saw nothing but a narrow stream of roaches, climbing the few inches of wall and vanishing into the glass. Too bad I didn't have one of Dancer's handy little wireless cameras to attach to one. See if I could get a glimpse at the other side. I wondered if they were normal earth roaches, or part of the disgusting papa roach that used to hang at Chester's. Unfortunately, they're indistinguishable to me. I backpedaled from the wall and squirted up into the slipstream a half second before the mirror exploded, spraying razor-sharp splinters of dark glass across the floor. I'd felt it coming. A vibration on the other side, as if the blow of whatever implement or spell had struck it, required a second or more to reach my side of the portal. By the time I dropped down again and crunched across broken glass and still more roaches, the wall was just a wall. Access to my prey gone. It changed nothing. 4 children had been driven into the streets to their certain death, for amusement. There aren't many things I hold sacred. Kids are one of them. I never forget. Never stop until I finish my job. The men's faces were etched into my memory. Their time would come. I stalked through the brewery, restless, unsatisfied. It was nearly dawn. That liminal time when night became day, villains vanished, and vengeance got shelved. I spend my day doing normal things like laundry, cleaning, checking in at the orphanage, modifying and monitoring my many obligations, dropping by the Abbey to train initiates, and catch some time to read the latest translations. I derive a great deal of satisfaction from doing my part to make our world safer. Tonight I'd failed, and it would be 12 long hours before I got to try again. As dangerous as night in Dublin was, day ran fairly smoothly, as if darkness and light had struck a compact of their own, apportioning order to the day and chaos to the night. I like the nights better. Carpe noctem, not diem. My days drag. Night's when I feel most alive. I banged out the door and exploded into the wet, foggy morning, tucking my head against a hard drizzle. As I was about to kick up into the slipstream, a sudden movement from above caught my attention. I paused and glanced up to watch something roughly the size of a playing card falling from the sky, end over end. I have a theory about people. Actually, I have a lot of theories about people, but this particular one goes, if someone throws something at you, you're either a catcher or a ducker. I've never been a ducker. I've learned the hard way that it's sometimes wiser to be. Still, instincts being instinctual and all, I jumped and caught the object while it was a few feet above my head. Ow! I exclaimed. The edges were sharp and cut the tips of my fingers as they closed around it. Cursing softly, I wiped the blood on my jeans before turning my attention to the card. 4 inches by 3, about a quarter of an inch thick, it was fashioned of alternating strands of green and black metals, woven together in an intricate, repeating Celtic knot pattern. It was beautiful. I'm Irish to the bone and proud of it. I love my country, my heritage, the fierce resilience and pride of the Irish people. This was fine work, done in the old way. Lovely but slightly rough, as if smelt and beaten by a blacksmith. I had no idea what it was, or why it had fallen from the sky. Shrugging at yet another mystery, I turned the metal piece over. What do you want? Was chiseled into the metal in light green letters. A dozen instant responses took vague shape in my mind. Seriously, it was a bloody long list. I rolled my eyes and was about to toss it in the gutter when I saw something shimmering at the border and retracted my hand to inspect the card more closely. I dropped it, as if burned. A spell was etched into the metal, nearly undetectable in slightly darker shades of green on green around the perimeter. A person with normal vision would never have seen it. Years ago, I'd have instantly blamed Riordan for any spelled thing I found. But he was gone, and in our new magic-enhanced world, the possibilities were vast. Another she-seer, Enyo, had told me just last week that some of the Fae lording over cult-like encampments in the rural areas were believed by many to not be Fae at all. None of her wary sources had been willing to elaborate on what they really were, but they'd insisted the charismatic, powerful beings hadn't descended from the true race, and that those of us at the Abbey should give them wide berth. Which, of course, only made me want to go exploring. I stared down at the metal card on the pavement. What was its purpose? What did the spell do? I shivered, grateful I hadn't muttered a wish aloud. I like wards. They're practical, straightforward, and don't usually bite you in the ass when you use them. Spells, on the other hand, are convoluted, dangerous, and unpredictable things, especially when blood's involved. I glanced down at my fingertips, then back at the card. My blood was smeared along the top edge. Bloody hell. I wasn't picking it up again, on the off chance I hadn't already activated whatever the spell was meant to do. I'd learned more than I ever wanted to know about blood spells from the monstrous Rowena. There was no way I was giving it a second shot at me. nor was I willing to leave it lying around for someone else to cut themselves on. I towed the thing into a nearby gutter, watched until it vanished down the drain, disappearing into the vast watery tunnels and caverns of Dublin below, then kicked up into the slipstream and headed home. 4. And Shazzy's Got Stormy Eyes. Shazam, what is going on here? I wrinkled my nose as I stepped into my bedroom, peering through the gloom. The dark room smelled funny, like a zoo. Fecund. I've always liked that word. Just not in my room. The glow of Dancer's stereo cast enough light so I could see Shazam had either doubled in width or there was something next to him on my fluffy, freshly laundered cloud of a white comforter. Coupled with the strong animal odor, it could only mean one thing. You know the rules. No eating in bed, I rebuked. No blood, no guts, no gristle in my sheets. I didn't think that was too much to ask.
I'm not eating. That's all you think I do. I do other things, too,
came the derisive sniff from the darkness. My eyes fully adjusted now. I could clearly see the outline of a carcass lying next to him, furred and lifeless. Like what? Saving leftovers for later? I slid my sword off over my shoulder, propped it against the wall, and unzipped my jacket. He said smugly,
I have a mate.
Holy hell. I froze, half out of my jacket. Thoughts collided in my brain too fast to process, leaving a single horrid image. Sharing a bed with a mating hellcat. I'd take blood, guts, and gristle any day. I flipped on the light and nearly burst out laughing. But I'm not foolish enough to laugh at a hellcat who might be mating. Shazam was sprawled on the comforter, one massive, tufted paw clamped tightly around the neck of an utterly terrified, exhausted creature, keeping it pinned to the bed. It was no wonder I'd thought it was dead. Stretched on its side, it was barely breathing. Round, golden eyes wide and fixed on nothing. There was froth on its muzzle and whiskers. Good grief! Shazam had brought home a palace cat.
This is Onome,
he informed me proudly. I shook my head, not certain where to begin with this latest escapade of his. He certainly kept things interesting. Shazam, you're a sentient, talking, highly evolved being. That, I stabbed my finger at it, is a cat, and barely a quarter your size. Let the poor baby go. She looked traumatized, deeply.
You're not the boss of me.
Am too, I reminded. You agreed to that. Where did you find her? Have you considered that she may already have a mate, a family of her own? He smirked.
Brought them too, Tiny Red.
I dropped my jacket to the floor, guns and knives forgotten, and glanced hastily around, realizing I should have seen this coming. Shazam had been obsessing over wildlife DVDs for the past few months, looking for new game to spice up his nightly hunt, I'd thought. But he'd been searching for a girlfriend. Solitary creatures that lived in grasslands and steppes, palace cats were the size of a domestic cat, with stocky bodies, shaggy, dense fur, stripes and ringed tails. I wrinkled my nose again. They were also known for scent marking their territory, which explained the foul odor in my bedroom. How many and where? He shrugged nonchalantly.
Don't know, don't care. They aren't Onome.
I dropped to the floor and peered beneath my bed. A dozen yellow eyes glared out at me from fluffy faces, regarding me with identical expressions of hostility. Low-set ears flattened to their heads. A single side of their mouth drawn up in an Elvis-like sneer. Sometimes I feel like I live in a cartoon. There were 6 palace cats from the far reaches of Asia, sneering at me from beneath my bed. As they began to growl, I bit back another laugh. Once I began laughing, I would either hurt Shazam's feelings or lose what little respect I managed to command with him at times like these, and said firmly, "Shazam, you will return all of them to wherever you found them."
"Will not."
I poked my head up and glared at him. "Will, too."
"Can't make me,"
he said airily. Technically, that was true. Handling Shazam took patience and tact. I pushed myself up from the floor. "When did it, on a May, eat last?"
"She will eat after we mate,"
he said grandly. "Does it really look like she's about to jump up and mate with you anytime soon?"
"She's gathering her strength."
"She's scared out of her wits." My first goal was to get the small, terrified cat away from him. She needs food and water. Earth animals can't go as long as you without eating. Let her go, and I'll get some food for... I glanced under the bed at my sneering, growling companions and sighed. Our guests. Shazam had been in Dublin with me for over 2 years, and I knew it had been a big adjustment for him. I'd found him on a planet in the Silvers, living in another dimension, half mad from long solitude. He was the only one of his species left, and I could only imagine how lonely that must be. Perhaps he should have a mate. Perhaps the palace cat might grow to like him. Who was I to say he shouldn't have a family of his own? Could he have a family of his own with an earth animal? Did palace cats have large litters? What the bloody hell would I do with half a dozen palace/hellcats? My brain thinks in Batman quips under pressure, a defense mechanism that keeps my chin up while the world goes to hell around me. This time, it married an old Star Trek episode to my favorite comic book hero and pronounced, "Holy tribbles, Batman, we've got trouble." Swallowing my mirth, I demanded, "Can you have babies?" He gave me a strange look.
"Children? Of course."
"Is that what this is about? Do you want to make them with her?" Violet eyes gleaming, he chuffed with amusement.
"That is not how children are made. One day you will know how children are made."
I raised my brows. I'd figured out how children were made when I was 5 years old, sitting unsupervised in front of a TV all day with a remote control. I wasn't sure I wanted to hear how he thought children were made. "If she doesn't eat, she may die." Assuming she didn't expire from shock first. "I'll be back with food and water." As I turned toward the door, I shot a withering look over my shoulder. "I mean it. Let her go. She's terrified of you." He sniffed.
"Riveted by my prowess."
"Catatonic with shock."
"Overcome by my magnificence."
This could go on all night. "Pinned by your paw," I said dryly. "If you're so certain of yourself, try removing it and see what happens."
"She will remain in my thrall,"
he said confidently. I shut the bedroom door as I left. The last thing I needed was a horde of hostile palace cats coming after me, attacking my ankles. I could imagine too many ways things could get even weirder than they already were. I had 7 palace cats in my bedroom. It wasn't the first time Shazam had brought something unusual home with him, but none of those things had ever been alive and required sustenance. Although I stock fresh meat and blood for Shazam, there was no way I was taking bowls of it into my clean, cream-carpeted bedroom, which already sported an odor challenging enough to eradicate. No doubt I'd be tearing the damned carpet out. Or moving again. My eating habits have changed over the years. Unlike most people, I have little to no emotional attachment to food. I see it as necessary energy and prioritize it in that order. Fat first, protein next, carbs last. I need it fast and efficient, so I stock my various residences with canned tuna, canned coconut milk, chocolate bars, and high-carb snacks. I glanced at the closed door of my bedroom down the hallway and finally let my laughter bubble free as I grabbed bowls and began opening cans of tuna. 25 minutes later, the palace cats had devoured 19 cans of tuna and nearly a gallon of water. They were going to need to pee and do other bad-smelling things. Not that I believed the odour in my bedroom could get much worse. I spend my nights in the dirtiest parts of the city. I like to spend my days in tidy surroundings. I was stretched back against the tufted velvet headboard of my bed, legs crossed. Shazam was sitting on the dresser, alternating between peering beneath the bed at his mate and her family and giving me the evil eye. I waited in silence. He tended to come around to my viewpoint more quickly if I gave him time to work things through himself, offering the occasional gentle nudge.
"I did nothing wrong,"
he said finally, sourly.
"I get bored when you're gone."
"So come with me. You used to all the time."
"I miss something, Yi-Yi,"
he said plaintively. "Oh, my friend, so do I. Many things," I said softly. "What?"
"Something,"
he said, his eyes filling with tears.
"I don't know."
Beneath the bed, I heard claws scratching the carpet as it was prepared for use as a litter box. "If you return them, Shazam, we'll figure this out. I don't want you to be lonely. If it's a mate you want, we'll find one. But you can't abduct a wild animal and her family and decide she's going to be yours. You have to move slowly. Give her time to get to know you. And it has to go both ways or it's ownership. Living things aren't property. You can't take them simply because you want them." It was my job to teach my bombastic, powerful friend how to live among us, and I took it seriously. I didn't cite the rules and expect him to obey. I tried to help him understand why the rules mattered. He slumped in a puddle of depression.
"She can't talk, and she hardly even thinks. She doesn't know the world is bigger than her cage or this room. She's never seen the stars and hunted on wild planets. I'm not what terrifies her. Everything terrifies her."
His head drooped to the top of the dresser, and he put his paws over his eyes. "She's not your equal and never can be," I said, vocalizing what was bothering him. He said wearily,
"She is not."
I smiled wryly. Over the past few years, I'd done what passed as dating for someone like me. Each time I tried, I ended up feeling more alone, not less. Fascination isn't love, and pedestals are hard, uncomfortable, and only big enough for one. Some people get a home with family and friends. Some people get a pedestal. Perversely, those on the pedestal hunger for the normalcy of a home and family, while those with a home and family hunger for the glamour and excitement of a pedestal. Further compounding things, the magic of the song enhanced my Shisir gifts. I'm physically stronger and have to hold back all the time. Careful, restrained sex is an oxymoron in my book. I get more release from exploding a few of Raiden's punching bags. "Will you return her then? All of them?" I added. Precision was a must with my moody beast.
"Yes, Yi-Yi,"
he said with a gusty sigh. After a moment, he lifted his head from the dresser. His violet eyes narrowed and shot a meaningful glance at my left hand, which was still cold and black.
"It's happening again."
"I know."
"Bigger now. It doesn't hurt?"
he fretted. "No, I'm fine." He assessed me intently, as if seeking reassurance of that. Then his body disappeared and only his head remained, his large, expressive eyes gleaming with love. I smiled. "I see you too, Shazam." His disembodied head nodded regally.
"I will return after I've hunted Yi-Yi."
Then all of him was gone. I dropped to the floor, peered beneath my bed, and watched with relief as the palace cats popped out of existence, one by one. I stood beneath the spray of a long hot shower while he was gone, washing my hair, shaving my legs, and considering my left hand. The stain had retreated to beneath the crook of my elbow. Although my hand was still black, even the nails, my fingers were no longer quite so cold. I had no idea why it happened, or what caused it, if anything. It was possible it was simply random. Sometimes, when my hand turned black, I was in the midst of a dangerous situation. Other times, I could tie it to nothing threatening in my vicinity. Each time it happened, I felt oddly shaky afterward, and had found eating helped allay the strange enervation. I flexed my hand beneath the warm spray. It didn't hurt. Well, aside from the brief stabbing pain I'd felt earlier when it shot up beneath my nails, the wraiths in the cemetery had been repelled by it. What had the hunter done to me that night so long ago? I hadn't seen any of the enormous winged beasts in our skies for years, and I'd been watching, waiting. I had questions. I'd found no reference to the hunters in the Abbey's vast libraries, but then I still had the lion's share of the collections to wade through. It was slow going, sorting through the bits and pieces of my Sheseer heritage. I read for hours a day, sitting with those at the Abbey who were scanning the ancient fragile scrolls and books to create an electronic library with cross-referencing tags that will never decompose. It should have been done long ago, but the prior headmistress of our order had been more inclined to let our secrets rot than share them. I turned off the water, wrapped a towel around my body, and used a second one on my hair. As I toweled it dry and sorted through the damp tangle of long red curls, I turned my thoughts back to the problem of Shazam. He'd been different lately, with fewer moments of lucid brilliance and more of emotional angst. I was worried about him. When he got back, we were going to have a long talk, and I wasn't going anywhere until I figured out what to do to snap him out of his funk. If an emergency came up, he was going with me to take care of it. I should never have let him stay at home while I'd gone out patrolling the past few months. After nearly 7 years together, I knew being alone and unseen, as he'd been in Olean, was the worst thing for him. I smoothed a light oil on my hair to keep it from going completely wild, grabbed my clothes off the counter, tugged on a pair of faded, ripped jeans and one of Dancer's old faded t-shirts, a white one with, "Holy shift, look at the asymptote on that mother function," emblazoned on the front. Wearing his clothes made me feel like a part of him was here with me. Although, I wasn't sure he'd be particularly impressed with my life. Lately, it positively brimmed with routine. Epic adventures were a thing of the past, fey battles forbidden. Sighing, I retrieved the sword that I wasn't allowed to use for its universe-given purpose from its perch within reach of the shower. I love my sword. I pet it. It soothes me. Cold, hard, frequently bloody, we're two of a kind. Made for war. But with a bit of work, we shine right back up again. Double-edged, the straight blade swells in thickness and width as it nears the guard. The blade, apart from the hilt, is 34.5 inches long. Most of the time. In battle, I've seen that length increase and decrease. Dancer was never able to identify what it's made from, but it's oddly light, yet weighty at the same time. Razor sharp, and has proved unbreakable. Although the blade shimmers alabaster, the grip is fashioned from engraved lengths of ebony and ivory metals woven together. The guard is dark as midnight, and resembles narrow wings that arc back toward my hand. The heavily engraved pommel is formed from the same obsidian metal as the guard, and is always cold. Ornate, dark symbols, a cipher that has never ceased to stump me despite the considerable time I've wasted over the years with pen and paper trying to work it out, flow the length of the blade on both sides. The symbols often move, swirling too rapidly for me to transcribe. When I fight, My sword burns incandescent, and I often find those undecipherable symbols seared into the flesh of our victims. Most of all, it feels good in my hand, as if it was made just for me. And one day, I just know deep in my bones, I'll get to use it again. I padded out into the bedroom. My fingers tightened on the hilt. There was a man sitting on my bed. Not Faye. But considering he'd breached my many booby traps to gain entrance, there was no way he was human, either. 5. I put a spell on you.
By Loki's balls,
the man said, shaking his head.
You're not at all what I expected.
Expectations limit your ability to perceive things. I try to have few. I leaned against the door jamb, assessing him, sword deceptively at ease at my side. He scanned me back, absorbing the bare feet, the holes in the knees of my jeans, the face void of makeup, the tumble of wet hair. His gaze hitched briefly on my left hand, and his eyes flared infinitesimally, then narrowed.
But you're a mere child. How did something like you get your hands on the fairy sword?
On February 20th of this year, my last birthday, I'd decided to commit to an age. As I was somewhere between 21 and 23, I split the difference and settled on 22. Casual and without makeup, I knew I looked several years younger. It worked for me. Strangers often underestimated me. I shrugged and said nothing.
Well, hand it over and let's be done with it,
he said, pushing up from the bed, hand outstretched, eyes fixed possessively on the softly glowing blade at my side.
Time is short. I've much to do.
I laughed in spite of myself. He was shorter than me, with a lean build, wearing black jeans, boots, and a green shirt. Wavy raven hair swept back from the high forehead above a narrow face. His eyes were nearly as emerald as mine, with tiny amber flecks and alight with amusement. I was the one holding the sword. As far as I could tell, he wasn't carrying a single weapon. I don't think so.
We made a deal. You will honor it.
I made no deal with you. He spanned the distance between us in a sprightly leap, smiling broadly.
Oh, but you did.
He caught my hand in his and lifted it to his lips, kissed it, then held it between us and glanced meaningfully at the cuts across my fingertips. Right. He was wearing black and green, like his calling card. His hair was black and his eyes were green. What was with people? Wasn't anyone normal anymore? Was having a color theme the new trend? That was a cheat, I said irritably. You made the edges razor sharp and flung it at me. He cooed brightly.
And you caught it. There will be no welshing. You plucked it from the sky, offered me your blood, and made a wish. I granted it. You owe me.
I didn't make a wish, and you didn't grant anything. And I didn't offer you my blood. You took it. Through deceit. Green eyes danced with mischief.
I just love that part, don't you? Blood is blood, no matter how you obtain it.
His gaze shifted, swirling with menace and mockery. That's a trap. You can't sucker people into spells. He clasped his hands together beneath his chin and sneered.
Oh, please. As if your history isn't positively mired in tales of stupid humans lured into unsavory deals and contracts and their repercussions.
He snapped his fingers sharply beneath my nose.
Wake up, child! Pay attention! Fools fall! It's what they do!
I growled. I'm neither a child nor a fool.
By my standards, you're both. You didn't have to catch it. I presented an opportunity. You took it. Pay up. The sword is mine.
I said coolly, I didn't make a wish, and you didn't grant one. I'm not giving you the sword. He hopped with delight and did a fast, merry dance in a tight circle, as if pleased with himself beyond enduring. I half expected him to kick his heels together and break into a sprightly jig. Then he spun about to face me, applauding with gusto. Clearly himself, not me.
That's the very, very, very best part,
he gushed, eyes sparkling.
I did grant your wish. You just don't know it yet.
Not good. Which of the many half-formed desires that had sprung to my mind when I read his calling card had he chosen? And in just what convoluted manner would it be granted? History was full of genie-gone-wild tales and rabbit-paw stories. You never got what you asked for. You got a version of a wish as razor-edged as his calling card. Something that would either harm me or benefit him. Or both. I still wasn't giving him my sword. He was going to have to take it. If he could.
Oh, I can.
He leered, leaning nearer until our faces were inches apart. I went motionless, searching his eyes. Flinty eyes narrowed with cunning antiquity. Something old and deadly lurked beneath his sprightly demeanor. I'd underestimated him. He employed prancing gaiety for the same reason I allowed people to think I was younger than I am. Who are you?
A name for a name,
he cooed. A small price to know my enemy. Danny O'Malley. His eyes twinkled with mirth.
You may call me Oz. That's A-O-Z. And all capitals, by the way.
Gotcha. The A is silent, I mocked. He'd pronounced it Oz. What are you? He laid a long finger to the side of his thin nose, as if pondering what answer to offer. Finally, he said,
those who belong here.
His face shifted and changed, the bones sharpening, skin drawing taut and far too pale, eyes narrowing, all playfulness gone. I caught a sudden reek of soil, blood and bones on his breath when he hissed.
Unlike the treacherous fairy, who think to take what is ours, not once but twice. Give me the sword, child. Undo it now.
The command affected my head, my limbs, similar to something Riordan had once done, although he'd merely forced me to eat a candy bar when I was hungry, not give away my most prized possession. And I was horrified to feel my hand rising, preparing to hand him the hilt of my sword. Apparently the spell agreed with him. We'd made a deal, and I had to honor it. I was ensnared by his power.
Stop!
An imperious voice thundered, and my hand froze. Fingers locked on the hilt. Oz spun to face the intruder, hissing,
get thee gone, fairy!
I blinked, startled. Inspector Jane had just sifted in, joining us in my bedroom, and stood a dozen paces away, on the opposite side of my bed. He wrinkled his aquiline nose and said,
by the bloody saints, what is that smell, Danny?
I shrugged, taking pains to avoid direct eye contact. Meeting the gaze of a fey prince is never a wise thing to do. First, your eyes bleed. If you hold their terrifying, inhuman gaze too long, it said your mind will hemorrhage as well. I've never tested that theory. My brain is my finest weapon. Don't ask. I hadn't seen the inspector in years. Not since he'd undergone the transformation from human to fey. I nearly hadn't recognized him. The head of the old Garda, Dublin's police force, had once been a rugged, barrel-chested Liam Neeson lookalike. No more. He'd become a towering, otherworldly being, with a stupefying gaze of opal-kissed skies, threatening thunderstorms. Hair the color of sunshine glinting off fast-running streams, and a lithe, beautifully muscled body of the Light Court. He smelled of fresh dew on morning petals, the crush of spring grass beneath my boots, the fertile, earthy promise of forest awakening from a long winter and a raw, to-die-for, sensual pleasure. All trace of rugged humanity was gone. Mac hadn't changed that way. Sure, her hair had lightened and lengthened, but she'd remained human like us. I scanned him intently, found nothing to define him as having been born of our race. Inspector Jane was fey with finality. I eased my sword down a notch, keeping it at the ready, trusting no one in the room but myself. As the inspector, Jane had once taken it, leaving me in a trash-filled street, badly wounded, on the verge of bleeding out. Was I supposed to believe he'd now sifted in to prevent me from losing it? I narrowed my eyes and assessed Oz. I'd drawn conclusions while we'd talked. Not fey, not human, but magical, and smelling of earth, blood, and bones. There was an old earth god in my bedroom, and he'd cast a spell on me. And now there was a fey prince in my bedroom too, carefully muted at the moment, for which I was grateful. But who could say how long that would last? Oz despised Jane and, apparently, the entire fey race. I said to Oz's back, "You want my sword so you can use it to kill fey." He whirled on me, eyes narrowing to slits of green fire.
"Better us than them. Give it to me now, you fool."
In spite of myself, my hand arced upward.
"Danny, don't,"
Jane murmured. My hand dropped again. I'd have nearly liked Jane at that instant, if he hadn't added in a voice of coercion,
"You will give it to me instead."
My hand went back up, and my feet began a traitor's walk toward him. A puppet. I was their bloody puppet. It incensed me, enough to want to stab them both with the weapon they coveted. Oz said coldly, gaze fixed hungrily on my sword,
"My spell was first. Hand it to me now, child, or I will raise your motherfucking world."
Torn between commands, my hand went still, and I pondered its motionless state. Spell to my left, voice of power to my right. If they kept tugging at me, what might happen? Not to me, but them. Especially if I added my left hand into the mix. I eased black fingers around the hilt of the sword and laced my hands together. Jane's gaze fixed on the subtle coupling, then shot to my face, searchingly. Still, he continued to work at my will, as did Oz. I could feel ancient, inimical power rolling off them, and knew, though neither was speaking, both were furtively attempting to bend my hand their way. Excruciating pressure escalated inside my head, so I tucked the bulk of my brain into one of my boxes and braced myself. I'd learned long ago how to distance myself from pain. Two very different forms of power crept over my flesh, slithering under and around, seeking control. One brilliant and summery, one dark and earthy. Two arcane arts met on my hands, mingling perhaps with something of the hunter's ancient power, and mixed as badly as oil and water with an undercurrent of dynamite. There was a swirling tornado of magic gone bad building, growing larger and more flawed with each passing moment. Then abruptly, power exploded from my hands and slammed back into them. Jane roared and flinched. Oz shrieked and clawed at his face. Both turned to snarl at me. I shrugged, flexing my fingers to make sure they were under my control again. "You shouldn't try to take a woman's sword." Jane said sternly,
"Danny, that weapon is far more dangerous than you know. Only a fey can handle its power now."
Oz snorted,
"Don't listen to him. The fairies seduce and lie."
"But gods don't," I said derisively. His eyes narrowed and he gave me an appraising look.
"Perhaps not entirely a fool."
"Neither yours nor his," I warned. Jane said,
"Danny, what happened to your hand?" "Yes, what?"
Oz asked, eyes narrowing. "No clue." That was the truth, but I was done answering questions. I'd formed theories and I wanted answers. "Let me guess," The gods are back, awakened by the song. Long ago you warred with the Fae. You've decided to start that war up again. And to do so, you need my sword.
Pretty much,
Jane said flatly. And how long have you known this without bothering to tell any of us? I fired at Jane.
Not very,
he said, bristling at my tone.
They returned weak and hid, biding time until they regained power. Only recently have they begun to show themselves. We were weak because of what you did to us.
Oz hissed at him, then snarled at me.
We didn't start the war. They did. Turning your race against us. Once your race prayed to us and we listened. We were good to you. Once.
Try to take my sword again, you'll die.
I'm not the only one who'll come seeking it. Others won't be as generous as I. You don't want him to come after it. You never want him to come. It won't be only your sword he takes. Do yourself a favor and hand it over to me. You'll be glad you did. If he comes for you, you'll discover the true meaning of hell.
I let my eyes go empty and cold. I'm not afraid of hell. I lived there once. And if I have to go back again, I'll swagger through those gates with fire in my blood and war in my heart. And I'll take no prisoners. I meant it. I have little fear. I have a great deal of fury. Inequity, injustice, incites a slow burn inside me that consumes me with deference for neither self-injury nor casualties. I sometimes think I'm a hair trigger away from becoming something else. A thing I don't understand. Oz said sneeringly,
Good luck with that. His hell is a place you can't begin to imagine. Eternal. No escape.
Or, I said with acid sweetness, I could give my sword to Jane, and you could try to take it from a prince. But oh, wait. If that were possible, you would have taken it the last time your races warred. Seems to me, giving it to Jane would pretty much shut the old gods down.
Yes, Danny,
Jane said quietly.
It would.
Oz hissed.
You're so certain you prefer the human race answer to the fairy over us. We guided you. We didn't turn our backs on you until you betrayed us.
I prefer the human race answer to no one but itself. We don't need or want either of you. I'm standing here with two alien races, both vying for control over man.
We're native to this world, not alien.
Oz growled at the same time Jane cut me off with,
That's not true, Danny, and you know it. I once was human. I still hold the same hopes and fears for our race as you do, and adhere to the same priorities I once did.
Oz said derisively,
You're fey. You don't feel and you don't belong on our world.
This is our world, I said coolly. And as far as I'm concerned, neither of you belong here, and I don't care if you were human once, Jay. You're not now.
Danny. I'll take the sword to the Queen,
Jane said. For which I have only your word. No thanks. I'll be keeping it. Or, I fished, dying to see Mac again. You could bring the Queen to me, and I'd consider handing it over. Jane was a mostly good man, with a fatal flaw. Well, two. One, he was a fey prince now. Two, he'd not been able to resist taking my sword once before for the sake of the common good. Pretty much every phrase that begins with the word common instills unease in me. Common knowledge, common good, common welfare. Somehow common man never seems to have much of a say in those common definitions. Politicians and kings make those decisions, and it's the common man who dies when kings go to war.
It seems we have an impasse,
Oz said with silky menace.
Two of us don't require sleep. You do.
He folded his arms over his chest.
It's only a matter of time, and we've an infinity of it. Once you've wearied, one of us will take the sword. Or
You may choose your successor.
I glanced at Jane and knew instantly he wasn't willing to wait that long. He was already changing, no longer concealing his power, but allowing the facade he'd adopted in order to shield me drop away, infinitesimal bit by bit, permitting me time to cave before he turned the full, mind-numbing beauty and horror of a prince of the Court of Seasons on me. I shivered. Fey princes are sexual beyond human tolerance. They can instill desire in us, amplify it, feed off it, and throw it back at us, 1,000 times more potent than it began. It's too much for us. It chars a woman down to ash inside her own mind, leaving nothing but a willing slave. I might have run Jane through with the sword if he hadn't already begun letting his glamour fall. Now, if I were to lunge for him, he'd simply blast me with the full strength of it. And I'd be on the floor, with no thought left of killing him in my smashed mind. You wouldn't, I said icily.
I'm sorry, Denny, but I don't dare let it fall into their hands. This isn't personal.
He'd said the same thing to me years ago when he left me lying in that trash-filled street. Spell check, I growled. When you do something to a person, it's personal. That's the funny thing about us persons. I laid down my mental grid and kicked up into the slipstream. Nothing happened. I sighed. Extreme emotion and extreme arousal can short out my she-seer powers, and it always happens at the worst possible times. I'd been working on the extreme emotion flaw and had made progress with it. It wasn't quite as easy to master the other fault. I had to get aroused to work on it, and, well, that hadn't happened in a while. I cast rapidly about for another option, finding only one. It was a long shot.
Give it to me now,
Oz commanded.
And I'll kill him with it. The fairy permit only slaves to live and demand worship. We aren't, and don't.
As Jane's glamour continued to fall by slow degrees, still allowing me time to hand it over willingly, I glanced down to where both of my hands were wrapped tightly around the hilt of my sword. I shuddered as his inhuman sexuality began nudging the edges of my mind, looking for a sweet spot, an easy way in. He was trying to do as little damage as possible, for the moment. Shivering violently, teeth chattering, I ground out, "You're willing to shatter my mind for it? What do you think your queen will do to you?" My eyes blazed. I felt tears slip from them as I met his gaze, and didn't need a mirror to know I was weeping blood. He said sadly,
"Ah, Danny, she will most certainly kill me, but she will have the sword. I'm willing to die to protect our race and yours from these vermin."
He'd said our race and yours. There it was. I knew it. His allegiance was to the Fey, not us. I closed my eyes, grinding my teeth together against the cruel teeth of power now tearing aggressively into the edges of my mind. When I was younger, I experienced a Fey prince's compulsion twice and survived. I was older and wiser now. I took my long shot, focused on the ice in my hand. I welcomed it, beckoned it to spread throughout my body, course through my veins with absolutely no idea what I was embracing. In a battle for your life, your sanity, your race, the weapon you have is the one you use. I felt a sudden prick of pins and needles through my entire body, a buzzing deep in my flesh, as if my limbs were waking up from a long time of being numb. My skin cooled and shivered on my bones, feeling strangely elastic and supple. Blood thunder crashed in my head, slamming against the confines of my skull, as whatever the hunter had left beneath my skin responded, and flexed, and grew. A wave of dizziness took me, and I nearly stumbled as sudden stars exploded behind my eyes, and I had a fleeting glimpse of a vast nebula-drenched nightscape superimposed in the air in front of me. Then it was gone, and the inside of my head felt calm and cool and silent as the deepest reaches of space. I didn't have time to analyze it. Didn't think. Just opened my eyes and flung my left hand at Inspector Jane. The print sifted out a mere fraction of a second before the bolt of pale blue lightning exploded in the precise spot he'd been standing. The crackling energy struck the south wall of the room, blowing it apart from floor to ceiling. Plaster exploded, wood splintered, and bricks tumbled away, leaving a gaping hole where the wall had been. My dresser listed dangerously on the edge, then plunged four floors to the street below. Snarling, I whipped my gaze to Oz. He dematerialized instantly into a cloud of murky green fog that compacted, narrowed down to a tight stream, and shot out through the opening blasted in the room. I stood there a moment, leveling my breath, waiting, while the energy surging through my arm ebbed, until at last it was gone. My legs felt like noodles, and my hands were trembling. So much for my warding abilities. They'd failed to keep out both Old God and Faye. Push come to shove, I might end up having to sleep on the heavily warded private residence levels of Chester's. And I so didn't want to do that. Then again, I had no idea if they were warded against gods. I pushed the sleeve of my tee up and inspected myself. My arm was black all the way up to my shoulder, with thin tentacles of dark veins spreading across my left collarbone. I let the sleeve drop and looked out over my bed into the pale morning beyond where a sea of rooftops stretched, and farther out, the white caps of a slate-grey ocean. A heavy drizzle had begun to fall, and a sudden breeze gusted rain in, soaking my fluffy white comforter. I rolled my eyes. My bedroom had been through hell in the past few hours, but every rain cloud really did have a silver lining. At least it didn't smell so bad anymore. Assassin. When I was 9 years old, Rowena told me a dangerous caste of Fae had infiltrated our city. Slender, diaphanous, beautiful, with a cloud of gossamer hair and dainty features, they were capable of slipping inside a human and taking over their limbs and lives completely. Once they assumed a human skin, they were no longer detectable to she-seers, and thus camouflaged, vanished forever, beyond our reach, to prey endlessly upon our race. This made them a most deadly threat to our order, she told me in a hushed voice, who could possess her charges at the Abbey at any time. In fact, she confided, they had. But, and there was always a but with the old bitch, she had a special charm that she, and she alone, as Grand Mistress of She-Seers, could employ to see inside a person to the despicable life-stealing Fae within. At 9, nothing seemed far-fetched to me. I'd fully expected to find the world beyond my cage as densely populated by superheroes and villains as my world on the telly. For nearly a year, Rowena steered me down the corridors of our abbey as she inspected her girls, guided me out into the streets and alleys and businesses where we hunted the dastardly villains. A secret team of two, tasked with a great secret mission that made me feel important and good. And when she'd identify a gripper, with a charm that never worked for me, we'd return to her office at the Abbey where, with great gravity and ceremony, she'd place the luminous sword of light across my upturned palms and command me to save our order, perhaps even our world. She taught me to be quick and stealthy about it. She told me how and where to stab and slice and kill. No one suspects a child, not even when they carry a sword. Most thought it a toy. I rarely needed to employ extreme velocity to complete my mission. It was easy to get close. Adults fret over lost, crying children. Do whatever you must to save our world. No deceit or ploy unjust, she'd taught me. The end justifies the means. I've come to understand the means define you. Although they are exceedingly rare, grippers exist. That wasn't a lie. There is, however, no charm that allows anyone to see them. I took 23 lives that year, and I don't know why. Mothers, fathers, daughters, sons. I carved holes in their families, shattering their hearts and their worlds. Perhaps they crossed her in business dealings. Perhaps they looked at her wrong at the post office. Regardless, none of them had been possessed. In one of her journals that I didn't find until I was older, chronicling her own greatness with chilling narcissism, Rowena had penned, "The child was sent to me to address my grievances and right those wrongs done me, controlled by a penurious toy I purchased from a street vendor." I don't know why she stopped, either. Perhaps there were only 23 names on her most hated list. Perhaps so many murders by sword garnered too much attention from the Garda, and she'd not wanted me caught and placed behind bars. Though she'd instructed me to hide the corpses, many were eventually found. The universe has a way of betraying those secrets we endeavor to hold near. The day I learned what I'd done, I decided there were only three courses of action open to me. Kill myself, because I was a monster too. Live the rest of my life hating myself, unable to ever atone, consumed by a heart of darkness that would cast no light into a world that badly needed some. Or lock the past up in a box with those other murders, and carry a heart as pure as it had once been into the present, determined to do better, inscribing the Latin motto on the tatters of my soul. Actus me invito factus non est meus actus. Acts done by my body, against my will, are not my acts. I knew each of my victims' names, and was able to locate most of their families. I protect them still. 6. High voltage, the unforgettable sound. I parked my motorcycle in front of the Abbey, grabbed the backpack that held a change of clothing for later, and loped into the front entrance of the ancient fortress, wearing ripped jeans, boots, and a white tank top that did nothing to conceal what was wrong with my arm. I wasn't going to hide whatever was happening to me. Isolated soldiers are a sniper's favorite target. My sword was slung over my back, knives in my boots, but in deference to the children on the estate, I carry no guns inside those walls. I can't bear the thought of an innocent coming to harm as a result of my carelessness. I love Arlington Abbey. With accommodations for 1,000 she-seers, the fortress is riddled with secret passages behind bookcases and fireplaces, has dozens of concealed nooks and cubbies, and has always held an air of irresistible mystery to me. From the meditation pavilion, hemmed by shaped topiary that legend claims once lived and breathed, protecting the abbey, to the elaborate maze that spans 7 acres near the lake, it was once a badly run mother house for women trained to be reclusive, cowed, and uncertain. Things have changed. We train, we fight, we get dirty and bloody and push each other harder all the time. The abbey's filled to capacity, with a waiting list a mile long to get in. Entry-level she-seers, initiates, can spend anywhere from 2 to 10 years in training as they learn to use their gifts. Those gifts we've been seeing since the Song of Making restored magic to our world, are unlike anything we've encountered before. Apprentices, who've achieved a level of proficiency sufficient to pass a series of difficult tests, will spend another few years in additional training. Some might never graduate to the final level. The adepts, those of us who've harnessed our gifts and serve as trainers for the initiates and apprentices. Then there's the Shedon, the council of popularly elected she-seers that govern the abbey. The Mother House is no longer a tyrannical prison of coercion and tightly controlled skewed press. In my youth, I'd blast through those corridors at full throttle, feared and distrusted by everyone around me. I used to hate that, seeing the fear. It made me feel alone. But I've galvanized my truths. Life is funny. It makes you choose sides all the time. Fearless people are outsiders. The fearful have many places to belong. They're the fluffy white sheep that stick close to the shepherds, let others feed, fatten and shear them, and spiral in a tight, panicked knot if a wolf draws near. When I'm surrounded by that herd, I can't understand the conversation that usually goes something like this. I'm scared. What do you think we should do? I don't know. What do you think we should do? I don't know. Let's ask somebody else. Panic ensues. Bah! I'm the dingy grey sheep. The one no one wants to shear and everyone forgets to feed. The one that gets pissed off and, with plumes of steam shooting from my ears, rather than lazing in the sun under the care of a master I have no guarantee knows how to survive any better than me, goes trotting off alone to hunt for wolf-slaying weapons. I'd rather be fearless and criticized than fearful and approved of. That's the bloody choice sometimes. Still, I've learned in recent years to bleach my coat. The better to blend. And when they aren't looking, I'm as grey as I need to be. It's easier on all of us that way. I think that's what Riordan does too. Concealing his inner beast with casual elegance behind cool grey eyes. I miss him. When I let myself think about him. Which is never. Today I stalked down vaulted stone corridors to the library, offering greetings and returning smiles. Though many of the women stared at my arm, it was without censure, only a lifting of brows and curious meeting of my eyes. When Shazam hadn't returned by the time I awakened from a quick nap on the sofa, I packed up and headed out to start my day. He has a way of finding me wherever I go, and I suspect he's often perched above me in a higher dimension, manifesting when he feels like it. I understand the need for time alone, and don't normally pressure him. But after last night's escapade, once he appeared again, I plan to do everything in my power to keep him engaged and by my side. "Hey, Cat," I said as I entered the library. The tall, athletic brunette glanced up from a computer screen and swept me with a level grey gaze. "Ugh, and it's grown." Cat was part of the She-Don, her she-seer gift, a dangerously sensitive empathy. Possessing the ability to read the emotions of those around her at their truest level, I've found her incapable of lying. "What do you feel? Read me." I dropped over the back of a chair and sat down across the table from her. She stared at me a long moment, eyes drifting out of focus, then said lightly, "You feel like you always do." "And how's that?" "Like Danny. Light and energy, a bubbling sense of humour, an exacting sense of personal responsibility and justice, and a heart the size of Ireland." She was silent a moment, then added, "And many, many private vaults that never open to see the light of day." My eyes narrowed. "Can you get in them?" "No." "That means you've tried." "I have." An unwilling smile tugged at my lips, as I thought both, "How dare you?" and "Good for you." She'd changed, toughened, moved beyond courtesy to necessity. We live in hard times. You can't keep your blades sharp by polishing them with a chamois. You have to sharpen them on stone. "The day I get in, I'll tell you. And the moment I do, I'll back out without looking around. I've no desire to know the secrets you've no desire to tell me, Danny. But the vaults of your mind are the greatest challenge I've found." And would forever remain that challenge. She wouldn't get in. I restructure my brain regularly and meticulously, planting decoys everywhere. Not even Riordan got very far past the surface. I changed the subject. "I had a visitor last night. Actually, two. 9, if you counted the palace cats, which I didn't and hoped never to smell again.